I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Security fencing is being installed around the U.S. Capitol in preparation for the Justice for J6 rally on Saturday. It's been organized by supporters of former President Trump, Look Ahead America, who have called the January 6 insurrectionists who were arrested political prisoners. Nearly 600 rioters have been arrested, facing an array of charges for storming the Capitol, fighting with the police, and trying to stop the voting that certified the election of Joe Biden for president. Officials are expecting something like 700 people to attend the rally on Saturday. In fact, some of the right-wing groups, including Oath Keepers and Proud Boys, are telling their followers to stay away. Meanwhile, a House Select Committee is investigating the riots and has asked for records from the Trump White House and executive branch agencies and told telecom companies to preserve their records. Claudia Grisales, congressional reporter for NPR, joins us by Skype. And Claudia, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So what does it look like near the Capitol today?
Well, we're seeing images from the Capitol, that fencing that we became so familiar with for about a six-month period after the insurrection is now up, forming this new perimeter for this event coming up on Saturday. However, the difference is that officials hope that this is very temporary. It would be up today and come down perhaps as soon as after the event on Saturday, if conditions allow, if they don't have any issues. So at least that's the hope among law enforcement and members of Congress.
And what about the presence of law enforcement? Are you beginning to see that?
So we've been told by agencies, Capitol Police and surrounding agencies, that they are putting up as much support as they can, extra support as they can for this weekend. They say they will be prepared for whatever may come their way.
And this will be on Saturday. Do we know if any members of Congress will be attending this rally?
Well, we understand that Senate Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy told Politico that no members of Congress are expected to be at Saturday's event.
They'll be out of town or just not at the event?
Well, both. Congress is not in session. They're not expected to be in session tomorrow. Actually, the Senate wrapped up early this week, and the House is not in until next week. So they are holding this event when Congress is not in session. And we've heard that no members of Congress are expecting to attend alongside any of these protesters.
Claudia, what can you tell us about Matt Brainerd? He is, I believe, the founder, creator of this group, Look Ahead America, the organizer of this event. What do we know about him, or what do you know about him?
Well, I'm just getting to know who Matt is. I reached out to the group yesterday and connected with him. He is a Trump supporter, and he is the founder of this group that you mentioned, the Look Ahead America group. And he told me that they expect hundreds to come on Saturday. I have heard some contradictory estimates there on smaller numbers expected. But that said, he did emphasize repeatedly that he expects it to be a peaceful protest.
And a protest, it's called the Justice for J6 rally, J6 meaning January 6th. So it's a rally in support of the people who were arrested for what happened that day?
Exactly. They are referring to these individuals who have been criminally charged, hundreds who have been criminally charged since the January 6th attack, as, quote, political prisoners. They claim that they're being unfairly targeted by the FBI, by the Department of Justice, and they're saying they want to raise awareness about this. They'll have draft resolutions in hand. They wanted to share this with members. Of course, again, they may not find any of those members at all on Saturday, but they want to raise awareness, they say, about these individuals who are facing criminal charges.
Any evidence that they're being mistreated or treated differently from other people who are in jail or prison?
They are trying to make claims that there are different treatments for these individuals. But of course, we have heard a different story from federal officials who have said that they are going through the same criminal justice system that everybody else faces when they are charged in a case.
Any response from Republicans who either attended that January 6th rally or supported the rioters or downplayed what happened that day, said it was a bunch of tourists? Anything from those members of the Republican Party?
Yeah, so those members, we have not heard much from them about Saturday. We have heard some other members who were not in attendance who have referred to these individuals as well as being treated, these individuals who've been criminally charged, as being treated unfairly. We have heard some members raise those claims. But when we look at those who specifically participated in that rally before the January 6th attack on the Capitol, there on the Ellipse, we're not seeing anything similar in terms of them repeating those kind of claims when it comes to this upcoming Saturday event.
And have we heard anything from former President Trump about the rally?
No, that's interesting too as well. Of course, there's still another day until this event. It's possible we could hear something between now and then, but no, he has not really added to this conversation this time.
What's the status then of the select committee? This is investigating what happened on January 6th, the riots there. It's chaired by Representative Benny Thompson. Tell us a bit about him.
So the chairman also heads up, he's a Democrat from Mississippi. He also heads up the House Foreign Relations Committee. And I'm sorry, I misspoke. It's the House Homeland Security Committee. So he's very familiar with threats to the homeland. This is a focus of his in terms of focusing on the threats in the form of domestic terrorists on U.S. soil. So this is a big focus for him. And he's playing a key role here in leading this panel. It's mostly Democrats because Republican leaders have boycotted this. However, two Republicans, that's Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, are the two Republicans on the panel as well. But he's leading this group right now in terms of a deep dive collecting public records in the weeks and months leading up to the attack from federal agencies. They're talking to tech companies to look at what records they'll recover there to try and begin this process of creating a public, comprehensive public record of what happened before that attack, what led up to it.
In fact, they called for, and I think I'm quoting here, communications within and among the White House and executive branch agencies. This would be the Trump administration. This was a couple of weeks ago with a deadline. Did they get the documents that they were looking for?
They said they got a lot of them, thousands of pages. However, there are still some outstanding requests. We should note that other committees have asked for similar documents and did not get those documents in return. So this panel is picking up a new fight that's been ongoing, searching for these records. So while they said that many were very responsive, they say there's still a lot of work to do to collect even more in terms of what they're looking for.
Do we know if they got documents from former President Trump? I'm assuming they want documents from him.
Yes. So the approach to that would be through the National Archives. That would be who would have records from the previous administration. And so that process, members have told me they expect it to be very cooperative, especially since we are operating now under a different administration, under President Biden's administration. So they're very hopeful they'll be able to get records tied to the former president through the archives, and perhaps if there are any other discussions with officials at other agencies as well.
And they also ordered something like 35 companies, a lot of including telecom companies, to preserve their records. Interestingly, McCarthy objected, saying that if they do that, there would be, I guess, what, some kind of hell to pay for that?
He did say he issued a warning. He said that these companies do not need to comply. And then second, he said if they do, they would be violating federal law and Republicans will not forget. So he did issue a series of warnings to these companies.
Do we know why?
Because there are concerns that some of these records, phone records, text messages that the panel could be seeking from, for example, telecom companies, cross the line when it comes to seeking information about members of Congress. This can involve Kevin McCarthy himself, other members who participated in that rally. Republicans say that's a line they're crossing that goes too far. And there are some legal experts out there who do side with them. So there's a little bit of a dispute here. However, when I spoke to one of the members of the panel about these concerns, this is Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California who chairs the House Intelligence Committee. He said to me that these members of Congress have been investigated previously by other panels, and there is precedent to do this. And he waved off any kind of claims that federal law would be violated.
So we should expect, not surprisingly, a fight for these records.
There, we could, yes, expect a fight on many levels for these records. And Schiff also mentioned to me that he would not be surprised if they had to go to the means of using subpoenas to get these records.
Let me ask you, and I'm asking about a book I have not read, but I've read a lot about. I'm sure you have as well, Claudia. This is the Bob Woodward, Robert Costa book, Peril, about both the very beginning part of the Biden administration, but also the last months of the Trump administration, and a lot about about January 6th, including a conversation that Mike Pence had with former Vice President Dan Quayle. How much has this sort of cast a pall over Washington?
Well, right. This was quite the bombshell that dropped this week. It was pretty interesting. I was sitting in a press conference with Republican senators. They had just left a meeting on a closed door meeting on Afghanistan, and they were asked about this these bombshells that had dropped. And it was clear that they were still trying to kind of shape how they'll respond to this, to these developments of even more details that are coming out from the past administration. Now, Democrats obviously want to know more. They want to get more details related to this. And this is all part of kind of their new post-Trump presidency oversight efforts that are taking place on many levels for several committees. So, yes, there's a lot of new interest surrounding this to be added to the investigations that members are looking into.
Well, we have to leave it there. Claudia Grisales, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
Thank you so much. Glad to be on.
Nice to have you with us. And that, again, is Claudia Grisales. She is congressional reporter for NPR, joining us by Skype. We're going to take a very short break and then carry on this conversation from a slightly different perspective, talking with Heidi Beirich and Clint Watts about helping us understand the threats from domestic terrorism and from political extremists. And we want to hear from you. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Nearly 600 people who stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6th to try to stop the presidential election vote count have been arrested. We've all seen the footage of them engaging in hand-to-hand combat with the Capitol Police and wandering the halls looking to hang then-Vice President Mike Pence and find House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. It was a shocking assault on our democracy by Trump supporters and members of extremist right-wing and neo-Nazi groups. The rally this Saturday in D.C. is in support of the rioters who have been arrested, calling them political prisoners. Well, yesterday, Jason Dolan, a Marine veteran and alleged member of Oath Keepers, pleaded guilty to conspiracy and agreed to cooperate with prosecutors in hopes of a lesser sentence. Who are these domestic terrorists? what drives their political ideologies, and how much of a threat do they pose? We have two guests who have joined us. Heidi Beirich is co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. She formerly led the Southern Poverty Law Center's intelligence project tracking hate and extremist movements in the United States. And Heidi Beirich, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, my pleasure.
Also with us and joining us by Skype is Clint Watts, Distinguished Research Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute here in Philadelphia. He's a former FBI agent, author of Messing with the Enemy, Surviving in a Social Media World of Hackers, Terrorists, Russians, and Fake News. Clint Watts, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, very nice to have you both with us. We have a lot to talk about. I want to pick both of your brains. But Heidi, let me begin with you first, talking about this rally that's going to happen on Saturday. Of course, there are things we do not know. Expecting something like 700 people. I was also reading that some of these organizations, Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, telling some of their supporters to stay away. What should we make of this rally?
Yeah, I think some of the most extremist factions, like you mentioned, the Proud Boys, who were involved in the January 6th riot, are probably not going to show up in D.C., which is a good thing. They have been actually dismissive about this event, called it a false flag, talked about it being an opportunity to round people up. That's not to say that we're not going to have a lot of people at the Capitol. It's a little unclear at this point. But luckily, some of the most extremist groups seem to be staying away, which makes this a little bit different than January 6th.
So who do you think it, I mean, again, I'm asking you to speculate, who do you think it'll be then?
I think it's going to be more conservative political types and, you know, people who are believing this whitewashing of what happened on January 6th, this idea that the people who stormed the Capitol were sort of, you know, involved in an action of civil disobedience and are being treated unfairly now. But I just don't think it's going to be the most hard line. I mean, that said, there was just an arrest a couple days ago by a white supremacist outside of the Democratic headquarters there in D.C. He was pretty scary. So you never know what something like this might attract.
And he had weapons in his car, correct?
Exactly. Weapons, extreme ideology. We don't know ultimately what he might have been planning. But, you know, we remember back to January 6th, there was also this person who placed pipe bombs around D.C. that they're still looking for, the FBI is. So you never really know how extreme the people are that could ultimately end up showing up.
Clint, let me get you in on the conversation. I mean, at this point, what don't we know about what happened on January 6th?
I think the big things really come down to two levels of communication, you know, at this point, which is what was going on between people that were in the protest movement that eventually became an insurrection and the White House. And then I think the next part is, was there anybody involved in Congress or congressional staff that was involved with the Stop the Steal sort of rally? And then what led to becoming the insurrection? I think those are the two big open questions. And you see that in some of the calls for files and records that is part of the January 6th committee, you know, that's looking at it in the House. So I think it's mainly those questions around organization, who was complicit potentially in it, and was it part of a bigger conspiracy? I think the last part is, to what degree was this organized as part of a conspiracy to deliver an attack? And I think what's come, you know, through in the charging document so far is there was a core group of very hardcore extremists from some of these militia groups that initially made the breach, and then a lot of political supporters followed through that breach, you know, with that movement, and shows the power of how one smaller extremist element in a large protest movement like this can lead to a total disaster over time.
Let me pick up on something, Clint. I'll go back to you because early on, some members of Congress, I should say these are Republicans, blamed Antifa, which is not true, or said it was just tourists visiting the Capitol that day, which obviously, if you looked at it, has nothing to do with tourism. Now the idea of political prisoners, what do you make of that?
Well, I think it's just a way to sort of restate this, and it's all just politics. If we've learned anything over the last 5 years or so, it's that someone is always trying to rewrite history and really obscure the truth and kind of battle with an alternative reality. And a way to keep that going is to really rewrite what happened on that day and to create this idea of political prisoners. I think the danger of it is, though, is the reason we have this sort of extremism, we have this extremism showing up at the Capitol impacting our democracy, is because political leaders are complicit in it. you know, 20 years ago, we were talking about Al-Qaeda. And one of the things we were always focused on was the ideology, those that speak it, and those that provide the justification for violence. If you fast forward to today, two decades later, those people that are speaking the things that undermine our democracy are our elected leaders in many cases. Those people that are inciting or mobilizing people to violence, picking the places, choosing the targets, pointing at Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and then we see an extremist group trying to develop a plot to kidnap her, that's coming from elected leaders. And so we're treating it very differently in this domestic context than we ever would have 20 years ago after the attacks on 9/11.
Heidi, let me go back to you and even going back to January 6th, the insurrectionist riot there. I mean, obviously, on the one hand, what we saw was violence perpetrated on Capitol Police. People died that day. People got injured seriously that day. I do not want to minimize that. But on the other hand, we had so many of these insurrectionists taking selfies and, you know, and exposing essentially their crimes for all of us to see, which seems like a kind of incompetent insurrectionist, if you know what I'm talking about. I want to just have you speak to that, how we make sense of all that.
Yeah, well, there was certainly that going on, and almost a mirth among some of the people who'd stormed the Capitol, some of these insurrectionists, about what they're doing. And, you know, what I think that really tells you is that a lot of them didn't take seriously what were happening, the events that were happening that day. They were proud of the fact that they were undermining the certification of the vote for Biden. They were proud of the fact that they were there with those people. They obviously weren't thinking about the fact that there would be fallout for them in terms of criminal prosecutions, because a lot of that information is being used as evidence in the 600 plus cases that have been brought against people who stormed the Capitol. And I think it's also kind of sad, because this sort of mocking, celebratory attitude towards one of the most sacred things in a democracy, which is installing the next president. And at the end of the day, that's what I worry about the most, both about rewriting the history, this revisionism related to January 6th, and the people who are involved in this activity and supported the Stop the Steal movement and so on. This is a degradation of our democracy. People are losing faith in the system because of their actions, because of this revisionist history, and because of lies that have been supported by a lot of public officials, in particular Republicans, about what happened that day.
And losing faith, we've got here in Pennsylvania and other states as well, you know, calls to take yet another look at election results from the 2020 presidential election, Heidi.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, the election was free and fair. That's been certified repeatedly. Officials across the board have said that. And yet there is an ongoing effort from the right to make it seem as though that's not the case, that our elections are rigged, that they're stolen from the rightful winners. You know, Trump used that rhetoric all throughout the campaign, but we just saw the same thing coming from Larry Elder, who lost the recall battle in California. And this is a really dangerous thing. If people don't believe that we can have fair elections, they're not going to believe in democracy, and they're not going to believe in the system. And just in a broader way, we have election officials who are being attacked violently online. So there's a whole lot of bad things coming out of the fact that this attack that really started from Trump on our political system, and the fact that it's being described as unfair and rigged.
Clint, anything you want to add to that? And then I do want to get some of our callers in, and I do want to play actually a clip from former President George W. Bush. But your thoughts about what Heidi just said there, Clint?
Yeah, I think the long-term risk to our democracy, I mean, we saw the acute risk, which was January 6th, the violence, you know, the potential that we could have literally the overturning of a single election. But I think just the daily banter of bogus allegations of fraud, you know, it really just comes down to, at one point or another, if we continue on this track, people won't believe in the outcome of the election, regardless of whether they win or not. And that leads to long-term apathy. This is typical of usually authoritarian regimes or dictators, you know, that host elections, but everyone knows that who the outcome is going to, you know, essentially bring, which is the authoritarian to power. If we lose that trust in our institution, that's the worst defeat of our democracy. And it's something the Russians, you know, used to talk about 5 years ago. Now we're talking about it inside the country. The Russians didn't do it. We've essentially taken that sort of a playbook and just used it on ourselves now. And it's kind of a depressing outcome of this era of disinformation and misinformation, all for political gain.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And again, I do want to play that clip from former President George W. Bush. That's Clint Watts. He's Distinguished Research Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, which happens to be located here in Philadelphia. Heidi Beirich is co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. And if you want to join our conversation, and we want you to do that, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play a clip from last week. This is former President George W. Bush during a speech on the 20th anniversary of September 11th, delivered in Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
And we have seen growing evidence that the dangers to our country can come not only across borders, but from violence that gathers within. There is little cultural overlap between violent extremists abroad and violent extremists at home, but in their disdainful pluralism, in their disregard for human life, in their determination to defile national symbols, they are children of the same foul spirit, and it is our continuing duty to confront them.
Heidi, how do we confront them?
Well, I mean, I think one thing that's good that has happened is the Biden administration finally has a national, you know, a plan put in place to deal with domestic terrorism that has quite a few prongs to it, and which puts white supremacists and anti-government militias at the heart of the threat to the homeland. You know, right now, over the last couple of years, we've already had every federal agency, DHS, FBI, et cetera, say that these are the predominant threats for domestic terrorism. They're also the groups that are undermining our democracy, as we saw on January 6th. So the fact that Biden's taking this seriously, I think, is an important step in the right direction.
What about for you, Clint? How do we confront them? And this is not just the United States. I mean, this is a global phenomenon.
Right. So I think the key thing is to focus on the most prolific actors. You know, what we tend to see is, for example, the individual who showed up at the Capitol this past week. The Capitol is now a symbol. You know, it's a magnet by which it draws all sorts of people for a variety of motivations. Some, you know, extremist terrorist motivations, some just in terms of fame or the desire to execute violence to these places, which means that we have to be, preemptive and preventative. And we got to use an intelligence-led approach the same way we built out over the last 20 years in the international counterterrorism effort. There are two things that have to be solved. One is, will we have some sort of terrorist designation process in the United States? We don't right now. And so we treat it entirely differently about how we conduct counterterrorism than we did international terrorism. We used to designate Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, and that allowed all the analysts and agents, all of the intelligence community, to pool its resources and share information, which is critical. And the second part is social media. Again, we've seen, you know, Director Ray, many others up there getting beat up for not monitoring social media. At the same point, you'll see other congressmen stand there and say, well, why were you watching my private social media feed when it's really public? And that has not been resolved. The committee, you know, they need to answer this regarding January 6th. If you want to stop a domestic extremism attack, and you're not designating, you know, terrorist groups, you got to let the investigators look at something. And they just haven't passed those laws. They've not had that real debate about what do we want our law enforcement to do.
And Clint, are you saying that's really where the important conversations are going on social media?
I think if you don't have a designation process around Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, like we did, you know, 20 years ago, we were able to say, okay, this person, for example, he's speaking the rhetoric of Osama bin Laden. He's talking about terrorist events. We can start an investigation and put the network together and understand. You know, it was putting the dots together, we used to say. It's very hard to put the dots together if you're not allowed to call an organization and connect the pieces, and you're not allowed to observe anything out in the open, which would give you the preemptive, you know, justification for executing an investigation. You have to have a cause. Right now, it's very hard to develop a cause because it's just no impetus, there's no logic, there's no reason for doing that.
Let me go back to you, Heidi, and this is asking about an individual. This is Enrique Tarrio of the Proud Boys. Allegedly, reportedly, apparently was an FBI informant. I mean, how much can these groups be taken down from, essentially from within, by maybe exposing some of their own hypocrisies, assuming they exist?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think law enforcement will be focusing on those kinds of things. And the fact that it was leaked that Enrique Tarrio was working with the FBI impacted the functioning of the Proud Boys, led to some defections in the ranks. Unfortunately, there's enough momentum behind that group that even with that disclosure and some infighting related to January 6th, we've still had many, many rallies, some of them that have turned violent, especially in Oregon, involving the Proud Boys. So it hasn't tamped down their activities. And I have to say that a lot of us thought perhaps the prosecutions around January 6th would lead to a diminution of activities by these extremist groups, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
Oh. Are there more as a result of these prosecutions?
Are there more? There have been more rallies. There has been more rhetoric around this. And actually, extremist groups have sucked up the same ideas that we're going to see on display this weekend in D.C., the idea that, you know, the defendants related to the January 6th incidents have all been treated unfairly. And so that rhetoric is coursing through extremist groups and, you know, making them also not feel any responsibility to what happened to January 6th.
And also used to raise money?
Absolutely used to raise money. It's a very good thing to raise money on. And you can see all of this on display on social media channels, which, you know, to Clint's point, I have to say, this is the place where most of the organizing, the propagandizing, the recruitment and so on is happening. And as long as that's allowed to happen relatively freely on those networks, these groups will continue to grow as they have over the last several years by harnessing that technology.
Clint, we're almost having a break here. You agree with Heidi about that?
Yes, absolutely. I, in some ways, and this is bizarre, I have more ability, or Heidi probably does, to really monitor what's going on in domestic groups than the FBI does, unless they have some sort of a predicate offense. And the one thing January 6th did do is it created hundreds of cases, and because it did, it allowed them to start moving in those investigations. So they're in a better footing now, but it's still, we're not setting them, the entire government, we're just not setting them up for success in terms of preventing against events like January 6th.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That is Clint Watts. Again, he's a distinguished research fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, former FBI agent. Heidi Beirich with us as well, co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. She formerly led the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. And you can join us, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us, WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with our guests Heidi Beirich and Clint Watts about what we are learning about the events of January 6th. There is a rally in support of the insurrectionists this Saturday in Washington, D.C., talking about who was involved, who should be held accountable, and what white supremacist groups have been doing since the insurrection and the dangers they still pose. And again, you can join us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Clint, let me just quickly go back to you. As you said right before the break, both you and Heidi are able to monitor these groups, but it sounds like you're also saying that the FBI is limited from doing that, and you want them to have more access to what people are saying online to each other?
Yeah, I think it's a couple of components. One, it's just a triaging problem from the FBI's perspective, or any federal or state law enforcement. You know, how do you, you know, evaluate a international, a global social media environment and understand who's in your jurisdiction, what you're allowed to watch, what is a real threat versus not a real threat? It's very difficult to do, particularly without a domestic terrorism designation. I think the second part is just, you know, in terms of what we want them to do or what we expect them to do, it's the line of what is protected free speech and what is posing a harm. And this is, you know, this is spread not just, you know, in the case of extremism, but misinformation, disinformation, let's say around COVID-19 or vaccines or election interferences. What is a real world harm from some of this social media activity that's out there? When should the government be involved and when should law enforcement step in or intelligence agencies step in? And when do Americans have protection around their speech and their rights. This gets confusing because much of the rhetoric that you hear that come from elected leaders today, or much of the rhetoric that you might see, can be classified in some ways as both, because you have elected leaders that are almost advocating for violence or advocating for violence at times. They're calling for protests and mobilizations. They're walking up to the line of what would be not so much protected free speech, but incitement to violence. And so where are the harms in the information space? And until we figure that out, you know, the FBI, DHS, any law enforcement will just be battered back and forth by whichever party is in power. And you can see this sort of happening, you know, after the January 6th, where some people claim they're being censored on social media or monitored on social media and should be able to say whatever they want. And others are saying, well, you're inciting terrorism. You know, where that line is really comes down to legislators, and there could not be a bigger chasm between the two parties right now.
Well, indeed. And Heidi, I mean, that this is a struggle we've had as a country about free speech and, you know, when yelling fire in the theater is, you know, cause for arrest.
Yeah, and it's even more complicated in the online space because the courts haven't really weighed in on where that line exists in terms of a true threat when you're posting stuff, you know, on the internet or on social media. So it's complicated by that, which also makes the kinds of things that Clint was talking about for law enforcement even trickier than they would be if this was in a real world situation. And I just want to back up too to what Clint said about public officials, which makes the issue around free speech even more complicated when you have, you know, elected leaders engaging in misinformation, disinformation, lies, QAnon conspiracies, and so on a regular basis. How are you to handle that?
Well, I will put that question out there, and perhaps our listeners can respond to that. Let me read a comment from Joe. He says the January 6th insurrection was fueled by Trump's big lie, among others, about non-existent voter fraud. All office holders must take an oath of office. Isn't it time to amend those oaths to require the utterances that all office holders must be truthful, be included, and include graduated consequences, not limited to removal from office for those who violate such an oath? And I wonder, let me toss that back to you, Heidi, whether that would get at some of the things we've been talking about.
Well, you know, I wish it was that simple, but we're in an era in which a lot of people in the parties are polarized, don't view truth the same way. So having people on the same page where you can make an assertion like this is true and this is false is very difficult in this environment. I mean, we had the president of the United States for, you know, all of 2020, Trump saying things that were clearly false and claiming that he completely believed them, had people following him in those ideas. So I think the polarization and the differences that we have that are so deep and stark right now make an agreement on what is quote unquote truth very difficult to ascertain.
Do you agree with that, Clint?
Yeah, it's almost impossible when you have two competing realities and two competing information environments, you know, at this point. I think the great example of this is Parler, for example, is an app. You know, it was out there or developed with the idea of promoting free speech, but it quickly became a haven for extremism and for things like January 6th. Now, they would say, well, we're trying to give everybody the opportunity to have a voice and say, you know, whatever they want. That's what freedom is about. But we always know that there's a balance between freedom and extremism and, you know, security and control. And so you have to make some decisions as a nation and regulate on it. I think where things have fallen down as compared to, let's say, 2001, 2002, is the legislators aren't legislating. Instead, they're using this gap to their own political advantage. We passed things like the Patriot Act. Then we remove some of those over time, you know, some of those provisions over time. We created different regulations around Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and we've taken some of those back with FISA over time. But that's part of a legislative process around making the country better. We just don't have that today. And so what you see, whether it's a Silicon Valley company or law enforcement trying to police between speech and violence, everyone just hedging and not really sure what to do, just trying to kind of survive the moment and figure out what the best pathway is forward and making up their own rules, which isn't the way we should do this. We shouldn't let companies or, you know, agencies try and just figure it out for themselves.
Heidi, let me go back to you. I've interviewed a number of former neo-Nazis, former white supremacists who are part of, you know, some of these groups that were not Oath Keepers and Proud Boys per se, but probably groups that preceded them. And there was a theme to their story. These were, in a sense, lonely people looking for a place to belong, often, you know, dysfunctional families, needed to feel like they were somebody, and this group gave them that ability to feel like they were a somebody. They left because they, you know, someone reached out to them. I mean, this sounds so corny in a way, but, you know, some other person reached out to them and saw some humanity in them and got them to sort of rethink some of their thinking about, you know, whiteness and Nazis and the sort of ideology of some of these hate groups. I realize we can't do that, you know, one-to-one-to-one, but I think it's an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that we're going to need as a strategy to deal with white supremacy and other forms of extremism are tactics to try to help de-radicalize people. And the problem is just so massive, largely because of social media, and we have so little capacity to do this. There's only a few efforts in the United States that target these issues that we're going to have to, you know, as part of a strategy to tamp down the threat from these groups, we're going to have to figure out a way to reach people and draw them out. And it's probably going to, you know, involve online technologies and interventions. But we actually don't know what works right now. And we don't have systematic evidence. So I think this is a big part of what needs to happen moving forward. How do we help people get out of these movements once they're radicalized? What do we do to stop them from being radicalized in the first place?
Do we know how to do that, Clint, or do other countries know how to do that?
I've not seen anyone that's successfully done that over time, to be honest.
It's, really?
We tried a lot of these approaches. I'll give you a couple examples that I think are good. But we've seen it, you know, Yemen and Saudi Arabia both tried versions of this. Quickly, many of these extremists, receded or recidivists ended up going back to those organizations as terrorists and fighting the U.S. So the re-education sort of model, the reforming, wasn't successful on scale. The U.K. has done some of it, and it's been, you know, successful at times, not in others. There are approaches that I do like, and one is called Moonshot, which uses former members of extremist groups to engage what they believe online to be people who are going to be extremists of that discipline over time. And that has shown some results. But the problem is it's very resource intensive. It takes a lot of time. It's a one-to-one or, you know, a one-to-a-few approach. And so it requires a lot of effort and manpower to do. And in most programs, they tend to lean towards the old DARE model of the more people we talk to, the better. But we should always be focusing on the next person that wants to show up at a January 6th or, you know, detain Governor Whitmer or blow up a bomb somewhere. That's where we should be focusing. So I like those more focused programs in the social media space.
And Heidi, even going back to January 6th, how many people, I mean, it's, again, I'm asking you to speculate, but how many people were just sort of caught up in the moment that, you know, by themselves, they would never do what they did at the U.S. Capitol. But when you're part of a mob and that kind of mob mentality, you do things that are out of the ordinary.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, there's been a ton of research on the mob mentality and how that can take over a group of people, right, and have them do things that they probably wouldn't have engaged in if they were on their own and not motivated in some way. But that said, we had people like Trump and other elected officials who built that mob, who intentionally created the conditions for that. I do think that the more extremist elements that were in, you know, storming the Capitol on January 6th probably might have engaged in that or something similar no matter what. But there were just a whole lot of Trump supporters and conservatives who ended up there. You know, one other element that hasn't been mentioned so much here is we've also experienced now the growth of really crazy conspiracy theories like QAnon, which it didn't exist 4 years ago. Now it has millions of adherents, and that made up a big chunk of the people who showed up at the Capitol. But yeah, the mob mentality matters in this instance.
Well, and picking up on that, Clint, going back to you, I was reading something like 15% of Americans believe in QAnon, which is that the U.S., or I guess the Democratic Party, is run by Satan-worshipping pedophiles who believe and, excuse me, who engage in sex trafficking.
Yeah, it's
insane.
Remarkable.
It's absolutely insane.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, at any given point, 5% of Americans will believe almost anything. I mean, there's quite a following for aliens and flat earth movement as well, you know, in certain places. If you believe one conspiracy, you tend to believe them all.
Hmm.
I think what's important, though, is that how would we get such a great number? And it's two parts, right? It's one part, you know, the demand for an alternative reality and the pursuit of it. It's, you know, it's using the ability of the internet to create a fantasy, be exposed to it, and actually move to and join in a movement, like you said, with other like-minded people that think like you think and like what you say. And so that's part of it. That was impossible before the internet. I think the other part of it, though, is just the demand for disinformation and misinformation. Never in the history of humans has there been a time where you can always find the answer that you want. It was very difficult to do this until recently. And so when you look at these conspiracy theories, you can create your own reality that's quite comforting. And, you know, when I concluded at the end of my research on my first book, you know, I realized that, you know, we won't be overtaken by the Matrix. We'll volunteer for it.
Wow.
And that's what you see with QAnon and some of these conspiracies is people willingly go towards those. They're not being shoved.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from Deborah. It surprises me that when the right tries to deny what happened on January 6th, that it was planned, very few refute their claims by mentioning the erecting of the gallows. That was not spontaneous. That had to be pre-planned and the materials brought to the Capitol. A question from Jane. Is there a link between the rise in bullying right-wing white supremacist culture and the longtime exploitation of gun laws or lack of gun control laws by the Republican Party? It is a lot easier to be screaming in your and bullying someone if you have an assault weapon hanging by your side or in your car. To you, Heidi Beirich, in response to Jane's comments, what do you think of that?
Well, I think that this, the bullying and whatnot is, you know, there might be a relationship to some extent there with weapons. I mean, really, when I think about weapons accessibility, what I'm worried about are lone actors who have access to weapons and can quickly, you know, cause devastation like we saw in El Paso and in Pittsburgh in recent years. But the bullying point about online is an interesting one because the online space gives you the ability to do things that you probably would not do in real life if someone was actually looking at you. And it creates this sort of boldness and trolling activities and nastiness and ugliness that people will engage in, which they probably wouldn't do if people could see them doing it. You wouldn't say these kinds of things in a park that you would find online, the kind of anti-Semitism and hate. So that's changed the way people live their lives. And I think that that matters. It's been a huge downside of the rise of social media.
Let me, we're almost out of time here, Clint. I'll just put a question or looks more like a comment from Jim. He says, that's the role of the press, or what's the role of the press in all of this and making sure the truth get out there, refuting misinformation, not sensationalizing these wild claims. We got about 45 seconds. Clint, final thoughts to you.
I think the way people consume information and the volume of information they consume has dramatically changed over the last 20 years. And if the press thinks they will convince audiences that something isn't true by writing a newspaper or just making a broadcast, that's not going to work. The people that call the New York Times fake news never read the New York Times. People that complain about the mainstream media never watched it. And so we have to create new messages and new messengers on new mediums to really engage those individuals so that we do change the availability of conspiracies to also offset it with the truth.
We have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you. Clint Watts, Heidi Beirich, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Heidi Beirich, co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. Clint Watts, distinguished research fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute here in Philadelphia. Also former FBI agent, author of Messing with the Enemy, Surviving in a Social Media World of Hackers, Terrorists, Russians, and Fake News. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.